I think I was 19 years old when I packed up the few things I had in a Ford Ranger and headed off to college in Austin. I was leaving behind everything that I knew and starting afresh somewhere else. It was a goodbye as well as a hello to whatever might be coming. Fast forward many years, and it was a very hard part of my life. My marriage was in shambles, and my wife and son and daughter were all packed up, moving back to Texas, and for a while anyway, I was staying behind. And I'll never forget the faces of my son and daughter as they drove away, waving. It was a painful goodbye and a hello to what? I had no idea. Fast forward even more, and my son, Luke, was starting at the United States Naval Academy, and we dropped him off for plebe summer, and never forget him walking away, and, you know, as young men might do, he's not going to make a big show, but he did stop and wave. So it was a time for saying goodbye and for him saying hello to whatever the future might hold. Shortly after that, my daughter marries, and she and her husband, Josh, are moving to Salt Lake City, where she's going to start work for Goldman Sachs. And I remember also them stopping by the house and driving off and waving goodbye, and then them saying hello to what their own future will hold. And then I certainly will never forget when my wife and I went to visit our son Luke at the United States Naval Academy, spent a weekend with him, great weekend, and he saw us off and we waved goodbye to him, never realizing that would be the last time we'd see him alive. Uncertain future. A goodbye and the hello that was coming to the future was not something we ever wanted to experience. The times in our life when we say goodbye to the old and hello to the new are unpredictable times. Be times of great joy, but also times of just life-altering sorrow. You never know what's coming next. Now, I like to think of these goodbyes and hellos in biblical terms by using the image of exile. You're leaving behind everything that you knew, and you're going to a new place. Now, that new place you're going might be okay. It also might be terrible. It might be a place where you prosper. It also might be a place where you greatly suffer. In fact, it might be a place where you suffer and there's tremendous growth. You just don't know. But there's a lot of uncertainty. Living in exile is full of challenges. It's full of setbacks. It's full of uncertainty. I've gone through various exiles in my own life. Went through a very dark patch in my life that I've alluded to a couple of times. For those of you who know my story, you know what I'm talking about. I've written a whole book about it, Night Driving. Very dark season in my life and where I was living in exile. And that exile was a place of chaos and confusion, just bewilderment as to what in the world was coming next. What God was doing with me, was there any hope for me? I contemplated suicide. It was an extremely dark and fragile time in my life. Thankfully, God bore me through that, carried me out of that, and took the shards of my existence and kind of glued them back together. I think he got a few parts in the wrong spot. but he kind of glued it back together, and so here I am. 10 years ago, I never would have dreamed I would be able to do what I do now, because I was living in exile. I was a full-time truck driver, a man who didn't have much future and didn't have much hope. It was my perspective. Little did I know that God was going to put me back together and give me a woman who loves me and ultimately introduce me to 1517, which is the Christian nonprofit that I'm able to work for and teach for. Never saw that coming. Well, I'm actually now back in exile right now, because it's been less than 2 years since my son Luke died. He killed in a hiking accident. And God is still putting me back together. And I don't know what it's going to, I don't know what it's going to be like when he does all of that, when he finishes all of that. But that's where I'm at. And it's a time of sometimes chaos. Of course, grief is like that. You never know what's going to come next. It ups and downs and these ambushes out of nowhere with the pain. And so living in exile is extremely difficult. But those of you who have been there, are there, or will be there, one of the things we learn in the Christian life is that it's usually during those times when we feel less in control, when we feel just overall less, like there's less of us, it's usually during those times when God is doing his greatest work in our lives. And usually it's because we can't get in the way as much, to be quite honest. Very often, God can do his best work in our lives when there's less of us. Because the more there is of us, the more ego there is within us, the more we're trying to control, manipulate events, the more that we want to kind of chart our own way and do our own thing, most of the time we just simply get in God's way. And so God will put us in exile at times in order that he can undo us and then redo us. Or as I prefer to say, to empty more of me out of me. So there's more room for him to put Jesus in me. Kind of take the plug out at the bottom of my soul and drain all of the egotism and the control and the I'm going to do my thing my way. Take more of that out of me. So there's space. There's room for him to do in me what he's wanted to do all along, but that I was getting in the way of. Now, unfortunately, exiles also are usually accompanied by pain and by confusion and by all of the things that happen when you don't feel like you're in control of your life. But that's okay, because having control is overrated. I know we love it, but it's like anything that we love, sometimes we overlove it and we tend to make an idol out of it. So God puts us in these places, just like he's doing with Jacob in the rest of the story that we're going to pick up. He's going to put him away from home, where he's no longer able to manipulate things quite as well as he did back home. And it's going to start to empty Jacob out of Jacob in order that there's more room for God to do in him what he wants to do. And he's doing that with me too. He does that with every single one of us. I like to think of the Christian life, this is an original me, this is Paul, as it's death and resurrection daily. You daily put to death in order that you might be raised to newness of life. In other words, he's conforming us to the image of Jesus, crucified, buried, and resurrected. That's what's happening every single season of our lives, really every single day of our lives. Put to death in order that God might do his resurrection work in us. Now, picking up Jacob's story, he's going to exile because of the events surrounding the deception of his father, right? He stole the birthright from his brother, and his brother wants to do what to him? He wants to kill him. And I don't blame Esau. I'm not saying it's right, but Esau's entire future had been stolen from him. When you're the oldest son and you're given the blessing of the firstborn, that means that basically not only do you receive a doubled inheritance, you're now in charge of the family. That had been what Esau assumed was going to happen his entire life. His entire future, from Esau's perspective anyway, had just been stolen away by his brother. Of course he wants to kill him. I'm shocked he didn't just go out right out and kill him, put an arrow in him. He was a hunter, he knew what to do. But it didn't happen, thanks be to God. And mom and dad get together and like, we got to get him out of town. Because if we don't, it's going to be the end of Jacob. So they say, you know what? Your brother, Esau already has two wives by now. Your brother already has two. You don't have a wife. So we're going to do what Bible people always did. You send him to the family reunion to find a wife. You thought that was an Arkansas joke. It's actually a Bible joke. When you're looking for a wife, you go to family reunions. That's just the way they did it, right? Marry within the family, son. Don't be going getting an outsider, somebody from Texas or whatever. Make sure you marry within the family tree. There's a good branch over there. So that's what he's going to do. So they send him to his uncle Laban's house. But along the way, something happens, and that's what we want to pick up with in just the next few minutes. This is Genesis chapter 28. Jacob's on his way. So he leaves with not much. Materially, he has nothing but a stick. That's what Jacob, in his own words, he says, I left with the staff in my hand. That's all he's got. So he doesn't have a beast of burden. He doesn't have anything else but a stick. That's what he leaves with. That's important to remember. He leaves empty. Now he's going to come back full. He's going to leave empty. He's got nothing. So he leaves. But along the way, something happens. Verse 10 of Genesis 28 says that he departed from Beersheba, departed from his hometown, goes toward Haran, and he came to, in Hebrew, Hamakom, which the New American Standard translates a certain place. The reason, just a little detail there, I like that because Jacob thought he came to a place. God knew that Jacob came to the place. The reason I like to point that out is because I don't know how many times in my life I thought I met a person. Turns out, from God's perspective, I met the person. Or I thought I came into a situation. It turns out, no, this was the situation. What I thought was a whatever, God's like, no, this is going to be it. This is going to be the person that I'm going to use to influence you or to become a friend or a brother in Christ. Or this is going to be the place that you thought you were just in for a short amount of time, that no, this is going to be the place where I'm going to actually do something for you and in you that you never saw coming. That's the beauty of things like this. Jacob thinks he's just finding a campsite. God says, no, this is going to be the place where I'm going to reveal myself to you. So here's Jacob. He spends a night there. Sun goes down. He takes one of the stones. And you can try, by the way, you can translate this, he put the stone by his head. The preface in a phrase there does not necessarily mean under. So if you've always been perplexed as to why he would sleep with a stone pillow, I mean, I do like my pillows firm, don't get me wrong, not that firm. You could also translate this by, because maybe in the sense of he's laying by it for protection. Just a little tidbit there from Hebrew. He lays down, goes to sleep, has a dream. And in this dream, he sees a sulam. It's the Hebrew word, sometimes translated as ladder, sometimes translated as stairway. It can mean either one of these. I'm guessing it was a stairway because if it's a ladder, it's kind of, have you ever gone down a ladder while somebody else is going up it? It's not OSHA approved. It's not safe. Probably this is a stairway. In fact, the whole scene reminds us of those ancient ziggurats, which are like the man-made pyramid-shaped mountains that are found in the ancient Near East. This is probably kind of a ziggurat kind of setup that he's seeing in this dream, with a stairway going to the top, angels going up and down on this sulam, on this stairway. And its top reached to heaven. Another little detail. The last time we heard about the top of something reaching heaven, that was back in Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel. They were trying to make their own man-made mountain, ziggurat, with its top in the heavens, and of course, didn't happen, because that wasn't what God wanted. Now, God is showing Jacob, okay, this is what I wanted. This is where I'm at. So it's top reach to heaven, and behold, angels of God are ascending and descending. Verse 13, and behold, the Lord stood. Now, your translations probably all say above it, don't they? That prepositional phrase in Hebrew, alav, can just as accurately, just as grammatically accurately be translated beside him. Either way. Like there's one, I think it's the Jewish Publication Society, in their translation, they have beside him. The Lord stood where? Well, to me, it's significant. You can translate it either way. Both are accurate. I prefer the translation beside him for two reasons. Theological, number one, because we have a God who likes to be right where his people are. He prefers actually to be a boots on the ground kind of deity, right there where his people are. Where does he want the tabernacle set up? On some high mountain, aloof from his people? Where does he want to be? Right there, middle of the camp. That's where he likes to be. That's where he likes to dwell in the midst of his people. And secondly, when Jacob wakes up, he says, I didn't know it, but the Lord is in this place. He didn't say the Lord is way up there. The Lord is in this place. So I love the image. This dream of Jacob seeing angels going up and down, but there right beside him stands the Lord. Now he's going to speak. If I were God, which is not too much of a stretch because we often think that way, right? If I were God, I would have set things up a little bit differently, right? If I were God in this situation and I knew what Jacob had just done, I would have given him a tongue lashing because that's what Jacob deserves. He had lied. He had taken the Lord's name in vain. He had deceived his father, who had done all of these very dastardly deeds. The thing that Jacob needs at this point is for God to come along and say, hey, buddy, we need to talk. What you did was wrong. In fact, it was utterly sinful. You should not have done that. And I'm going to let you know just how upset I am about your behavior. He needs a come to Jesus moment, right? But in this come to Jesus moment, that's not what he gets. I love to point out the monologue that God has here with Jacob, because it's indicative of the fact, once more, as we talked about in the last session, that the God that we're dealing with here is not some angry, malevolent deity who's just out to kill everybody, which is often the way the Old Testament is described by people who, the Old Testament God is described by people who have, you know, a bone to pick with Christianity. How many times have you heard the God of the Old Testament described as mean and bloodthirsty and heartless? Anytime I hear that, I'll be like, oh yeah, really? That's funny. Let's see what he says to Jacob here. Let's see how he reveals his heart to Jacob here. And here's what he says. Now I want you to listen for all the condemnation in these words, all right? And when you hear the condemnation, let me know. God says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, now I'm still waiting for the condemnation. Maybe it's going to be this next verse. Maybe it's coming. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Every time I read that, I get upset. It just rubs me the wrong way, because that's not what Jacob deserves. These are just like lavish promises from God. Does he not realize what Jacob has done? That's not what this guy deserves. That's kind of the way we operate, right? Now, if I were in this situation and God appeared to me and spoke to me this way, I'd be like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted. But if somebody else is in this situation and I see what they've done and God speaks to them in this way, I don't like it. Because, see, we operate with a double standard, right? When we've done something wrong, well, first of all, there's always reasons for it, right? Well, yeah, if you'd been around my wife the last week, you'd understand why I did that, right? Well, my boss, we've always got extenuating circumstances. We're always making excuses for what we've done, right? That's just the way we operate. But somebody else does it, you're like, dude, what were you thinking? You know what you're going to get. So when we receive mercy, we're grateful for it. When somebody else receives mercy, I don't know about that. Don't really like that much. But here's God appearing to Jacob, doing nothing more than speaking promises. In fact, this is God taking everything that he gave to Abraham and that he gave to Isaac and saying, now I give it to you. I'm passing on to you this blessing of Abraham, Isaac, and now it's going to be the blessing also of Jacob. Now, in the big picture of Scripture, something else is going on here too, because when he says, in your descendants, is the way it's translated here, seed, in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. That's a promise God made to Abraham in Genesis 12. He calls him forth. He says, I'm going to make you a blessing to all the families of the earth. Now, as you trace that promise from Genesis 12 into the story of Isaac and Jacob and then on, this promise is the promise of the Messiah. He's the seed of Abraham and the seed of Isaac and the seed of Jacob, who becomes the seed of the tribe of Judah, who becomes the seed of the family of David, who becomes finally the seed that's planted inside the virgin womb of Mary. So this, if you have ears to hear it, this is God preaching the gospel to Jacob and to us. And you, all the families of the earth, will be blessed. It's not just for the Jews, not just for the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's for all the families of the earth. So this message that God speaks to Jacob is not only one of good news in the sense of I'm going to be with you, Jacob, but it's also good news for all of us. This is the way that the Old Testament preaches the gospel to us in a different sort of way. And if you have the ears to hear it, you pick up on exactly what's being communicated here. And I would go even further. I don't know if all of you would go this direction or not, but I would go even further. I believe, well, let me back up. John chapter 1, we read, no one has ever seen God, but the only God who's at the Father's side has made him known. The Son of God has made the Father known. No one's seen God the Father, but if you know God, if you've seen some kind of manifestation of God, who have you seen? Jesus, you've seen the Son. So I would argue that any time in the Old Testament, whether it's him walking in the garden in the cool of the day, or appearing to Hagar under the image of the messenger of the Lord, or here appearing to Jacob, or as we shall see later in Jacob's story, wrestling with him all night. I would argue that all of these appearances, not only in Genesis, but stretching through the rest of the scriptures, is in fact the manifestation of the Son of God. That this is Jesus coming down, speaking to Jacob. And so Jesus is preaching the gospel to Jacob. He's the one who, whether you translate it at the top of the ladder or beside him, this is Jesus, this is Christ speaking these words to Jacob. Now, one of the reasons this becomes, when you understand it that way, one of the reasons this becomes so biblically beautiful is because when you take this story and you make a trip into the New Testament and you open up the Gospel of John and you go to the very end of John chapter 1 and you have Jesus talking with Nathanael, and Nathanael's amazed because Jesus saw him when he was under the fig tree. Jesus says to him what? Oh, you think that's awesome? You ain't seen nothing yet. You're going to see, Jesus says, the angels of God ascending and descending, not on some ladder or stairway, but on what? The Son of Man. This is Jesus' way of saying, all right, everybody, open up your Bibles to the book of Genesis and read what happened to Jacob when I appeared to him there and spoke to him there, when the angels were going up and down on that stairway that bridged the gap from earth to heaven. That story is revelatory of who I am. Because that stairway that joined earth to heaven is me. I am the one who bridges the gap between heaven and earth, God and man in one person. So if those angels of God ascended and descended upon that stairway to go from the terrestrial to the celestial, that was just a picture of who I am. I'm the one who joins God and man, heaven and earth in one person. When you understand he's the one who's speaking here in Genesis, then it adds even greater color to this story. It's also a revelation of the fact that Jesus has always been consistent in his mercy toward humanity. This is Jesus appearing in a true come to Jesus kind of moment And he's speaking words of consolation to this man who doesn't deserve it. Just like every time that he comes to us and speaks words to us and says, I love you. I forgive you. You are mine. I choose you. It's never because he looks and sees, you know, in our heart of hearts, we're really good people. It's not because he says, you know what? You've been a good son. You've been a good dad. You've been a good husband. Therefore, no, there's no because therefore when it comes to our behavior. This is entirely prompted by his own heart. Even before he looks at you, he loves you. And his forgiveness and his mercy are not contingent upon your worthiness or your behavior. It's contingent upon who he is and his will to love and to forgive. Which is just tremendously, it's the gospel. It's tremendous good news that it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you've done. I don't care if you've had to rent a storage center because you run out of room in your own closets for your skeletons. And you had to go get some more room because you've got so much there. And you live every day fearful that someone's going to find out what the skeletons are. If that's who you are, Jesus comes to you and says, you know all those sins that you're hiding that you're afraid everyone's going to find out about? I died for them. You are forgiven. It's taken care of. My blood was shed for every single one of those. Whatever your situation is, you're just like Jacob. And one more element here that I love is that what is Jacob contributing to this entire scenario? Nothing. He's got nothing. In fact, God appeared to Jacob when he was asleep, probably because he knew if he appeared to him when he was awake, Jacob would start talking. It's like he can't talk. He's asleep. He's entirely passive. He's in the middle of nowhere. He's got nothing but a stick. That's the exact opportunity I've been waiting for. Now I can speak to him. So the first three times we have recorded speech from Jacob, when he speaks to his brother, sell me your birthright, we see he's selfish. When he speaks to his mother and says, well, my brother's hairy and I'm not, so I might appear as a deceiver, we hear that he's just all about self-interest. He's a liar. And that's confirmed when he speaks to his father and says, I am Esau. That's the Jacob we've met when he's awake and active and speaking. It's only after he passively receives what the Lord speaks to him that Jacob has anything good to say. He wakes up and says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it. It takes God speaking to Jacob before Jacob has anything good to say. And Jacob basically echoes back this truth that was revealed to him by the Lord. That is a turning point in Jacob's life, because now we begin to see that Jacob is not only the sinner, but he's also the confessor. He's not only the one who's self-interested, but now, in response to this revelation, he has something good to say. He speaks the truth. And on the basis of that truth, that hope that he kind of slips into his pocket like a word, now he's ready to go into exile. And it will be a long time before God speaks to him again. He's going to spend 20 years in exile. He's going to be away from home, away from his father's family for 2 decades, and then God's going to bring him back. But he leaves with the most important possession you can ever leave when you're going into exile, the word of promise from God. So slip that into your pocket. I am with you. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to bring you back. And when you have that, you don't need all the other stuff. You've got everything that you need. So he goes into exile. And picking up the story with Genesis 29 and what follows, there's a lot that happens in exile. I just want to talk about a few things. The main thing that happens to Jacob in exile is he's no longer a single man, right? Yeah. Not by any stretch of the imagination is he a single man. So he first of all meets his beautiful, beautiful family member, Rachel. Falls instantly in love with her. And by the way, I don't usually give dating advice, but I do feel led to give this bit of advice. Don't do what Jacob, young men, if you meet someone that you are attracted to, don't follow the Jacob rule, because Jacob goes up and then he kisses her. Okay, that's fine, but then he wept afterward. Just not a good look. I'm sure she was pretty confused by this whole scenario. But that's what Jacob does. He sees her, he's overjoyed, and I will say something positive about Jacob here. That opens up a different side of Jacob. He's no longer just kind of the cold, calculating, I'm going to get whatever I want kind of person. He's also emotional. You can tell he's the crying is not just an act. He's overcome with relief, probably with love, with all of these emotions. Another side to Jacob. And we're told that he falls in love with her. He's willing to work, in fact. Once he meets Laban and they kind of get settled in the family, then, you know, Laban says, hey, we need to work out a salary for you. What do you want to be paid? And what he wants is a wife. He says, well, you know, you have this attractive daughter that I really love, so I would really want to marry her. And Laban says, okay, I tell you what, you work 7 years for me and she'll be your wife. And we're told that those just seem like a few days, because he was so smitten with her, so in love with her, so ready for that. That's a long time to wait, guys. 7 years, it's a long time. And when it finally arrives, when the 7 years are up, he's like, okay, been counting the days. We need to get this wedding planned. So they plan the wedding. And of course, that is when we have one of my favorite Bible verses. This is Genesis 29, and it's verse 25. It's one of my favorite Bible verses because it illustrates how you can pack so much into so few words. You don't need all the color. You don't need all the details. As soon as I say these words, you can picture the entire scene. The wedding has happened, and Jacob wakes up in the morning, verse 25, and behold, it was Leah. You see the whole thing, right? It's been a dark night. You've had your fun. You probably had too much to drink the night before. That's one explanation of how he didn't know it was the right woman. And rolls over, and behold, it was Leah. The deceiver is deceived. What does Michael Scott say? Oh, how the turntables. Is that right? Yeah. Oh, how the turntables. Oh, how the tables have turned, because now the deceiver is deceived. And, of course, he's upset with Laban. Laban works out a deal with him, though. He says, well, I'll tell you what. You work another 7 years, and then you can have Rachel. Now, just to clarify that, because people often confuse and they think that he had to wait 7 more years. He didn't. They just waited another week or so, had a second wedding, and now he's married to both Rachel and Leah. But he's got to work 7 more years. He's got to work 14 years in all for the two wives. So Jacob is now no longer a single man. He's now a husband. A husband multiple times over, because pretty soon what begins to happen? There's a baby-making competition, so you want as many people on your team as possible. And so both wives enlist also their maidservants. So now Jacob is a busy guy. He's fathering children, or attempting to father children anyway, through four different women. So he's got a little mini harem going on, really. He was a single man, and now he is a married man. And even though his situation is, I hope, very different than our own, if any of you have four wives, let's talk, okay? But he is now entering into the vocation of husband, which alters you. Because now you're no longer just a single man out, you know, doing whatever you do as a single guy. Now you have entered into a calling that is going to set your life apart from what it was before. Because now you have a responsibility to care for another human being. And when there's children involved, now you're entering into another vocation. You're entering into the vocation of being a father. And you have a human being, a little bit of human being, that you also are to care for. And there's a multiplication of little human beings in Jacob's family, especially on Leah's side. So the kids are coming. Now the wives are coming. Jacob has experienced what we all experience. We take upon ourselves a new calling. Or to put it differently, God brings into our life a new calling. Now I find this understanding of how God works through vocations to be extremely, let me put it this way. It opens up my own self-understanding in a fresh and a welcome sort of way. You see, we're all born with callings in life. The minute you're born, you have a calling. You're a child. All of you were a son. And so now you have a calling to be a son to your parents. If they're siblings, you're a brother. You get older, you get married, now you have a calling to be a husband. You have kids, you have a calling to be a father. Each of these callings, each of these vocations are what God uses in your life so that he can kind of use you as this mask to love and serve those who are around you. Now think about that, because for me, that was life-changing. Because now I realize that whatever I'm doing, whether I'm a son to my mom, my dad passed a couple of years ago, but whether I'm a son to my mom, or a brother to my sister, or a husband to my wife, or a dad to my kids, or a pop to my grandkids, or a scholar in residence for 15, 17, or all of these various vocations, what matters is that I have been crucified, and it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And that means that Christ is active in this vocation to love and serve through me those who are around me. And that also means that everything that I do becomes sacred. My vocation of a husband is a sacred vocation. My vocation as a father or a grandfather or a worker is sacred. There's no part of my life, there's no part of your life that's secular. Say that again. There is no part of your life that's secular. We have been lied to by a lot of generations now into thinking there's religious parts of your life and secular parts of your life, or sacred part of your life and then secular parts of your life. No, there's not. Every single part of your life is sacred. Every single part of your life is religious. There's nothing you do in a non-religious way, because nothing you do apart from God's activity in your life. So when you're a husband, that's a sacred calling. When you're a father, that's a sacred calling. It's sacred because God is inhabiting that calling in order to love the people that you serve in that calling. And this transforms your understanding of work. Work is no longer just something I gotta go do. No, work is the sacred calling where God is using you to do whatever you do. Doesn't matter what your job is. Think of it this way. It's a priestly vocation, whatever you do. Or to frame it a little bit differently. Whether you're a plumber, or electrician, or teacher, or CEO, or whatever you do, that is the place where you are a secret agent in the kingdom of God. You're like an undercover agent for God. Not to undermine things, but to actually be light in the midst of what is frequently darkness. Truth in the midst of what is frequently lies. Or if nothing else, just an example of a servant out to help others in the midst of what often becomes nothing more than just an ego-driven, self-absorbed, all-about-me kind of culture. So whatever you're doing in your vocations, whether that's at home as a husband or father, or whether it's at work, that's a sacred space where Christ is at work in you to love and serve the people that he's put into your midst. And that for me is transformative. It changes. When I was a truck driver, I would joke and I would say that my altar where I served as a priest had a diesel engine. The truck I drove around, that was my altar. That was where I was working. That was where I was sacrificing of myself to serve those who were in my midst. It's the same with whatever your vocations are in life. So that's where Jacob is at now. And what's going to happen in the course of his life, these next 20 years, is that God is going to use his marriages to make Jacob realize that he doesn't have it all together. He's going to use the growing problems with his family to illustrate also that he doesn't have it all together. And he's going to also use the troubles he has with Laban, his boss, father-in-law, uncle, all of that rolled into one. He's going to use all of that also to lessen Jacob. He's really preparing Jacob for the ultimate revelation that's going to come when Jacob returns from this exile, which we'll talk about in the next session, the whole wrestling with God part. But it's no different than in our exiles. God is using our vocations, our struggles also to lessen us in order that we might be ready to be filled by him. And this happens over and over because we tend to fill ourselves back up with ourselves, and so God has to empty us again to make room for him. And in his own time, in his own way, he brings us back from those exiles and puts us where he wants us to be again, to continue to love and serve those who are around us. But we're out of time for this session, so we're going to pick up the story at 11 o'clock when we come back and do a little wrestling. We'll see you then.